Welcome to the Private Practice Made Perfect podcast with me, Kathy Love. I'm a business coach who helps allied health professionals run powerful and profitable businesses in the disability sector. Join me for cutting-edge interviews with leaders in the allied health and business fields, along with plenty of practical content that you can use to make your business practice perfect. Hello, everybody. We have got Julian Whitehead in the podcast room today. Julian is a partner with Whitehead Legal, and they are lawyers who specifically serve health practitioners. Welcome, Julian.
Thank you, Kathy.
This has taken months for us to get Zoom to Zoom. Did we first speak in February?
Yes. This COVID has been tough on everyone, hasn't it? So it's great to be able to finally have an ability to talk.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit about who you are and what you guys do.
Yeah, sure. So Whitehead Legal, we exclusively advise in commercial matters in the healthcare landscape throughout Australia. We act for healthcare practitioners, only act for healthcare practitioners, be it allied health practitioners or dentists, veterinarians, medical practitioners, health entrepreneurs and health corporates. As mentioned, I'm a partner at Whitehead Legal, and Claire Whitehead has practiced in the healthcare landscape since 1983. And yeah, I've been practicing for almost a decade in this space.
Yeah. So talk to us a little bit about the business and who's in the team at the moment.
Yeah, sure. So we're remote. We work in Melbourne and Sydney. I'm on the ground in Sydney. Claire's on the ground in Melbourne. We have admin throughout Australia. So we've been fortunately with COVID, we've been used to working in this way remotely and off-site for a few years, but our team's it's concise, but it's we're productive and
Zoom ready, remote ready. Sounds good. And do you particularly work with businesses of a particular size, the really big guys or the middle-sized guys or the growing fast guys? Who's perfect for you?
It's a broad scope. So we've got startups startup physios who are just looking for a single single room for a periodic licensee arrangement in large complexes or shopping strips, and we've got multiple chaired dental practices and large scale optometry clinics. It really is a broad scope, and there's a lot of similarities. Of course, there's the small business limits there, but there are a lot of similarities between small startups and large scale health clinics that hopefully today that the listeners can get a bit of an idea as to where they interline and where they will get some benefit out of this exit planning.
So before we get on to our exciting topic of exit planning, what are the typical touch points where an allied health business owner should engage a lawyer?
So securing...
You've only got 50 minutes to answer. There are so many.
You start off with... The best way to start off for us is to get into the due diligence of it all. So, securing your practice and making sure your practice goodwill and intellectual property is protected. They're good starts for when you're considering selling.
But I think if we just kind of go a little more broadly, allied health business owners, I think they fail to engage a lawyer around signing that commercial lease. hustling up and copying, pasting some suboptimal employment agreements and independent contractors. Like I nearly sent you a message. I saw about three times on social media last week, almost the same conversation that has someone got a contract that they will share. And I mean, yeah, no. And I guess then they're the big ticket items, but I guess then a lawyer's also needed sometimes to kind of navigate some HR stuff or some licensing or intellectual property or trademarks. Are there any other kind of really big pieces of work that business owners really need the legal eyes?
You've hit the nail on the head with employees and their agreements. They're so critical in the transactions that we say is we have every matter has large scale negotiations on that. And actually getting your arrangements ready for your practitioner at your practitioners and your clinicians, their documentation, their actual say contractors, service providers, or employees. Yeah, that's critical to get that underway when you're considering selling. Anything else apart from what you mentioned? Well, again, you've mentioned lease, so you've hit the nail on the head there. Appropriate tenure, and again, we'll get into that appropriate tenure and making sure you have enough to satisfy a purchaser, to make sure you have that tenure that will not only satisfy the purchaser, but satisfy the purchaser's financier if they're lending to buy the vendor's practice.
Yeah. So hopefully, well, I'm sure today's conversation will sort of demystify the legal bit. So relevant. I was incredibly fortunate that when I had my practice, my lawyer was my neighbour. So, you know, there were lots of over the back fence conversations and great sort of on demand advice. And, you know, what we're going to kind of talk about now is how to get ready to exit your business. And I got advice at one point from a mentor when I had my practice that got me thinking about selling. I had no clue that I actually had an entity that had a commercial value. And I ask a question quite often when I'm presenting, you know, how long did I spend getting ready to sell, or how long did it take me to sell? And my answer is 10 years, that I realized at the 10-year mark that I had something that had a commercial value, and that every single thing I did from that day onwards was really about building assets and protecting assets and profitability and positioning, getting myself out of the business, getting myself out of clinical operations, blah, 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 blah. So it took me 10 years. So hopefully today we can speed that up for a few people. But as much as anything, it was mindset. But lawyers, I had lawyers, just my lawyer on demand the whole time. I just had no hesitation to go there and get his wisdom on something. It's just such a classic area, you don't know what you don't know. So exit. How do you start to finish? What are the very first steps?
That's a great term, start to finish. So when we are engaged by someone who's starting up, we can give an example there. We like to make sure that everything is ready for them to sell even when they're starting up. So we make everyone aware of all the things that if I was acting for a purchaser's lawyer, what I'd be asking in the future. So you start off at the end. You start off looking at town planning. You start off making sure that you have town planning permits in place and making sure your lease is a saleable, has an ability to be a saleable commodity.
Yeah.
You then work on to the intellectual property parts, ensuring that the business names are registered and making sure that, again, making sure that your employees all signed up and making sure that their restraints are all reasonable and enforceable.
Kind of bizarre to think that all of that paperwork is actually kind of what you sell. It's actually the operating systems as well. But to have those employment agreements, you know, crystal clear and signed, that is part of what goes in the box of what you of what you sell. That commercial lease, does it have the clauses so that it can be renamed to somebody else as well? Let's just kind of have a little bit of a spin on the intellectual property bit, because I got asked about that yesterday and I might get an answer from you that I can take back.
Possibly, yeah. Look, in this space for the eggs planning, you need to make sure that essentially everything is appropriately registered. A couple of items for IP, yeah, your business name, making sure that your practice operates under that business name, and making sure it's connected, of course, to your ABN, and being aware that the registration in itself of your business name is not in itself exclusive of ownership to use the business name. Only a trademark can give you that sort of protection. So if you need, yeah, if you need exclusive use of that business name, you really should register it. And that could be, say, if you have a practice logo that distinguishes you from someone from another clinic, then yeah, that's a trademark that can be registered and gives you exclusive right to use that asset. And yeah, it protects you and prevents others from imitating your practice. So those two elements of intellectual property for factual registration purposes and for hard protection are really important. And then there's the soft IP, which would be the social media and getting all your social media, Facebook and all that up and running and appropriate for your practice.
So how do your social media accounts become soft IP?
Well, it's not a formal registration process, so you can't have complete exclusivity over it. You can obviously link it to your accounts, but you don't have the protection that a trademark would offer. They are separate. Like you wouldn't have your logo just as a social media aspect. But yeah, they are separate elements. But there is different types of enforceability for trademarks, of course, compared to softer IP.
Yeah. Yep. Now, what about the situation where there is more than one business owner?
Multiple practice owners. Yeah. So when you are considering selling, there's always, well, there should be in place an ongoing agreement between all the practice owners. That if that is in place, then it will give a guide to the owners as to how they sell, how they value the practice, the appropriate notice that's required for the vendor or the owner who is wanting to sell, whether they're selling internally to the other owner or if they're selling it to the independent third party. Those documents, be it a partnership agreement or an associateship agreement, unit holders or a shareholders agreement, they're pretty critical in the early stages of a practice life. If you have multiple owners, you should be bound together in singularity rather than having an idea to sell and not really having something you can fall back and follow a path. Because most multiple practice owners that don't have for instance, if they're partners, there's a lot of partners that don't have partnership agreements that can have very complex sales because they haven't had the appropriate valuation methodologies.
You probably won't be surprised, but I am surprised when business partners, and I'm doing air quotes, have not a single signature between them. Like there is just fresh air. And they may have been running very successful businesses for X number of years, but there is nothing formal, which I don't know, I'm talking to a lawyer, but it's about the what ifs or in case of emergencies and it's about the serious stuff. What happens then? Hopefully I'm not the only one. Well, hopefully I am the only one that's seeing business partners without any documentation.
Oh, no, look, that's it's not uncommon. When one of the business partners is considering to sell, is you don't need to quickly sign up an agreement between yourselves and then sell, because it wouldn't be, it would be too late. I mean, if you want to sell, you can work it out between each other and how you value and how the incoming purchaser enters the practice. So there are ways and means, of course, to get around something that's not signed
completely missing
anything signed. Yes. Yeah. But a prudent purchaser will want to enter a practice with either an existing agreement between the practitioners, or will want to establish a prudent. These days, that they will want to establish the working agreement
on the partnership. Yeah. Alrighty. So I love this idea of start as you mean to proceed. So from day one, you are kind of operating with a seller's mindset, yes, or even a buyer's mindset, so that you are just filling the box with all of the bits and pieces that make it a real sellable and enticing asset, I guess. So getting ready to sell, I took 10 years. I'm pretty sure most people are way quicker than that, but I guess my 10 years was in a context when businesses weren't selling. Now they're being traded day in, day out. And I think most people listening would actually be really surprised with the volume of trade that goes on behind the scenes, because the banners on the front of the building don't always change. So what are the kind of the next steps when you've kind of in that position of, yeah, want to sell?
Speak to your advisors, speak to your lawyer to get yourself a practice sale ready package, essentially. Mm. When you do find a purchaser, if you have a broker or if you have even a cold call from someone, they'll want to see documentation. They'll want to see a whole range of information that essentially gives them an idea as to what they are entering into. So there's a number of critical due diligence items that should be disclosed. Whether or not they're disclosed in the initial meetings, or if they disclose once lawyers get involved and there's formal requests, that's a bit of there's no general rule on that. But we like to say if a practice owner is considering selling within the next year, yeah, it's prudent to make sure, we've mentioned before, employees are up to date, the lease is up to date, and all your practice histories are ready. So by that I mean when you started the practice or when you bought the practice, you need to find a town planning permit to hand over to make sure that the purchaser has that document, and to have comfort when they have that document. It's no good providing these documents a day before settlement, because it creates
yep. Chances are you won't be settling.
Yeah.
Anything else that you suggest from that kind of, I guess what I'm hearing is that you've got to be document ready, but you've also got to know your documents are clean and correct. Anything else in that press go?
Yeah, well, we can dive into some of those intricate DD items and explore why they're important. And what I mean before about ensuring that you're sale ready when you essentially buy or when you start up is, if you go back to the town planning, you want to make sure that a purchaser's lawyer wants to. Or has their own comfort when they are buying from you. So if they ask for a town planning permit that has, say, one or two or three clinicians, allows for one or two or three clinicians to practice at any one time, they'll be happy with that if that's the status quo that they want to continue with. But if no permit exists, and you are practicing without permission from the council, then there may be things you need to do between now and when you find your purchaser to rectify that status. It does happen that you need to make contact with the council and get revised town planning permits. But that's one little section of the DD that is fairly critical. Like the ramifications of not having these, say, permits in place, the purchaser is taking on your commercial risk of not having it.
Risk, yeah.
They might think that if there is an unhappy a patient or an unhappy competitor who tips off the council, and the council calls up and says, "Oh, we need to explore your permissions." It's things like that that we make sure that there is commercial risk that is satisfied on both ends. The lease, again, I can't reiterate how important getting your lease ready is mm-hmm. when you enter the practice or you're purchasing the practice. Even again, within 6 months of settlement, you can still get your lease ready if you have a good relationship with your landlord. All terms of the existing lease need to be properly checked by us or by your lawyer. The nature of your tenure, whether or not you have a lease or a sublease or a periodic license. Clearly, a lease is preferable. Subleases are tricky. I know a lot of your listeners will be under a sublicense or a periodical license arrangement. Purchasers and their financiers look at leases more favorably, but sometimes it is what it is. The complexities that come from the sublease or sublicenses arrangements are more settlement based, and they're more with your advisors actually getting you through to settlement, because you have to deal with sublandlords, agents, the head landlords, lawyers, and there's a lot of documentation just on that element, just to get the transfer of the lease and all that signed. The remainder of the period of a lease is fairly critical as well. And we mentioned before that the financiers look at the tenure. They look at your what you have, what the vendor has, and what the purchaser is going to be essentially buying. If you have a 1 year lease, it might not be good enough unless the commercial the price is low, but if the price is fairly significant, if we're talking about over a $450,000 practice, the financiers are going to need to see minimum 5 year terms with options of 1 to 2 further 5 year terms. Termination rights on those leases are hopefully ironed out before. If you have a good relationship with your landlord, you can get rid of any bespoke or individual landlord clauses that have a tricky demolition or make good requirements. Mm. Because they do create consternation to purchasers when they there'll always be an underlying discomfort as to why they're there. They're not normal. What's the landlord's intention in a few years? I'm buying your practice now, but is there that possibility that I might have to move down close by? And again, with the lease, the final critical element is whether or not you have exclusivity. And again, at the start of when you're buying or starting up, and again, when you're selling, it's always good to have it in there, because it maintains your goodwill. If you're in a complex with multiple tenancies, mm-hmm. and you're starting up and having negotiations with the landlord, you want to make sure that there's not another physio in the other tenancies, or you want to essentially restrain the landlord from in a few years. If your clinic is expanding and going really well, you want to make sure they don't have that great idea to put another physio in. It looks good. It creates value for your purchasers.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess there's also all those documents that you can never find when you need them, all the business certificates, all of the trading names, all of that stuff that just seems to miraculously disappear the moment you need to find it, and then you're begging ASIC at midnight. We've sort of touched on an IIP and a register for all of that and all of those certificates as well, and all of the business ownership documents or business partnership documents as well. What else? Anything else in this sort of ready to sell, green
ready
light
to
moment?
Sell. Yeah, the most I find the most important is, I know I've touched on it, is the employees. Get the employees signed. Yeah. If you have professional staff and have got a physio that has been employed for you for 5 years, and your purchaser, or if you believe your purchaser will take on that physio as a transferring employee when you do sell, yeah, you need to make sure you've got them in a documented state that is comfortable for the purchaser. If they're not restrained and they hold significant goodwill for your practice, then a prudent purchaser's lawyer will look at their engagement. If they're not signed, and go, they're a bit of a risk. What's happening with them? That's why, again, ways and means. It's not going to scare everyone off. You can have condition. You can have you can sign them up if the employed physio will sign up. You can't force them to sign anything, but you can ask if they will sign something. When you are negotiating with your purchaser, you may wish to have a condition precedent as to settlement, as to whether or not the high value physio will sign on and formally sign a practice a document that has practice restraints in it. Getting your annual leave and long service leave and sick leave entitlements also up and running for your non-professional staff and your professional staff as well. That is unbelievably critical. We see entitlements of up to $100,000, even in small practice transitions, that these liabilities, they're transferring liabilities. So the purchaser's looking at these liabilities and going, well, how are we going to deal with these? And we can get to when you actually sell, there's a lot of commentary that you can, a lot of ways that you can go about working with those liabilities. But be wary at the genesis stage, when you're starting up, when you're buying, that they are accrued. Their work don't have to have protocols to follow. But when you're selling, even 6 months to a year out, budget for the entitlement liabilities, or even speak to your brokers or your accountant, see if you can work out how much it is, what the value of, say, the sick leave or the long service leave is, and see if they can assist with the value of the practice, and see if there's any way that you can negotiate with the purchaser on the purchase price compared to the amount of entitlements that you have. If it's a nominal amount, it's not serious, but we do see a lot. Yeah. We do see serious amounts of liabilities.
Yeah, and such a good reminder given COVID, where there has just been such a different pattern of annual leave not taken this year, and what we're sort of predicting people will do behaviourally next year with their annual leave as well. Okay, so good reminder about the cash value of leave that is owing. Okay. Can we kind of just jump a little off track and maybe just have a quick chat about do's and don'ts regarding valuation as well, because you should have just seen Julian just about did a 360 in his swivel chair, because sometimes business owners are approached and they're completely cold and rabid in the headlines, and they're kind of pitched an offer that they may just sign forward and go with, or then they're kind of needing to kind of go sideways and get a valuation as well. What are your quick pros and your do's and don'ts around that, getting the business valued?
Always if you have a cold call or someone who wants to buy, of course, listen, see what they have to say. If they need that, they'll likely need the valuation for finance. If you can't sell for that price to that person without getting the valuation, of course, you're going to have to do it. Whether or not it's a good thing to have your practice valued and then it falls through,
it's great to know.
I guess the other thing with valuations is that you need to make sure that the valuers know your specific area. There are, of course, allied health practitioner and clinic valuers are specialized. So if your purchaser is not using one of them, you'd have to insist on a second valuation. Meet in the middle if you have to. Usual valuations. I know there's a lot of EBITDAs and 3x multiples thrown around these days, but it really is bespoke. You look at your practice, you know how much it's worth. Your accountant also will know how much it's worth.
So, the magic multiple question. I'm not sure that accountants always do know what businesses are worth, based on what I kind of hear from time to time. Are you brave enough to kind of give us a range of what multiple is?
Yeah.
What the going multiple range is?
Yeah, we're seeing three times EBITDA.
Yeah. Okay, so you better explain what that is.
Earnings before interest, depreciation, tax. The standard three times. I see in valuations, and I speak to accountants. They run that line off. Whether or not it is something that should be taken with. Yeah, you never know. It really is how much the purchaser is going to pay, because the value is how much that you want to sell for.
Yeah, absolutely. Or how much you won't sell for. Alrighty. So yeah, I think it's really an interesting practice to get a valuation. It can just light up some areas. It can be really motivating as well, was my experience, and clients have reported kind of similar as well. It also just means that you're sell ready and that you can potentially be a little quicker to step towards negotiations or invites that you might kind of receive as well. So let's kind of jump forward to the moment where there is a really interested seller and it's starting to get serious and you're really feeling quite out of your depth. Where does the lawyer come in and act with you and for you when you're stepping towards all of the selling proceedings?
Yeah, of course. So acting as a vendor, acting for a vendor, you're in fairly early. If there is a broker involved, that they'll be doing negotiations, they'll get to an offer and acceptance, and then usually and terms list or the actual offer is provided to the vendor's lawyer, and you produce the documentation on that basis. But the DD involved, we like to get involved in conducting DD as soon as possible to be able to input the requisite information into the sale documentation. So if you are, you'll have a general idea as to when you know what you want to sell. You speak to your lawyer. They give you essentially a list of what you need to do, what you need to provide us, so we can draw the documentation. But it really is at that critical juncture. You'd only want to go to the lengths of having your lawyer draw up the documentation once you have a formal offer and acceptance from your broker, or if it's internal, or if it's cold call, or between you and a practitioner. Then once you have real formal offer and acceptance, that's when we really dive in. And we speak to, we essentially take, step into your shoes, take over everything, speak to the purchaser's lawyer. Some are more than willing to self-represent, and that's totally fine. We of course advise that it's best to get a lawyer on both sides, because the purchasers might save money from not engaging a lawyer, but also on the other end, it does incur, unfortunately, it means that the vendor's lawyer and we project manage more than we really should be. We like to, of course, everyone likes to work with the other lawyer, because there's also commercial mindedness that they know what we're talking about. If there's complexities in sale documentation, you shouldn't really be speaking to someone who's not a lawyer about it, or negotiating with someone who's not a lawyer. But what you're actually signing is the critical clauses that are input in the documentation in the sale agreements are really based on what you give your lawyer as part of the due diligence package. So if you've got, revert back to the employee entitlements. If you've got $100,000 worth of sick leave for a couple of staff, or let's say $10,000. You can, we would look at the employee clauses in the sale agreements, and we would try and change certain elements to make it more favorable, keeping it our fair work, under the Fair Work umbrella. But there's ways and means that you can deal with liabilities and employee entitlements once you provide appropriate disclosures. So there's most sale agreements, follow Fair Work protocols and include, say, percentage adjustments for employee entitlements. And you might see in some sale agreements, there's different percentages offered for different entitlements. For instance, standalone service leave calculations compared to sick leave calculations are actually different. There's 72% on one and 35% on the other. But that's purely because sick leave gets tricky because it's not paid to employees when they are terminated. And a lot of vendors, when you do communicate that with them, it's not, they don't like adjusting it because it's not, I can say it is common to adjust because it is a liability. It's a live liability. Most prudent purchasers and their lawyers will ask for it, for sick leave liability to be adjusted. If you just need to make sure that you have those figures available at hand so we can do our drafting without providing the documentation too early to the other side and then having to change things at a later date once due diligence is provided. The other things that are actually input in the agreements that are really important. I mean, there's default and all these other minor clauses, but they're clauses that are fairly standard. The ones that really need to be flagged are the contract warranties, the indemnities, if there's any patient claims, prudent purchases, again, they'll expect warranties documented in the sale agreement. You can't really get away from that anymore. But you'll also need to consider your practice restraints. So
Can we just go back to the warranties and a couple of examples of that? I remember having a ton of fun sorting through these.
Well, you can not. There's we see a lot of differing warranties offered. We have our standards set that we believe are fair and reasonable. But you're looking at you're warranting the status, the financial and the trading status of your practice. Your employees, your employee entitlements, are they accurate? There's no misrepresentations. Are there any ARPA or patient claims against you? Are there any supplier claims? There's the plant and equipment in good and proper working order. If you're warranting and representing that it is, that from when the purchaser signs the agreement, the equipment is in proper working order. So it has to be, so you can't be massaging something that's going to fall through halfway between signing the agreements and settling. It needs to, whatever the equipment, the state of the equipment was when you're signing, you're warranting that it will be the same at settlement. So that's critical for the equipment. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I heard you mention the word restraints, practice restraints. This is where, I spent most of my time with my lawyer. It's about what's on the other side, really. As the business seller, are you going to have obligations or not with the buyer?
Talk us
through these.
Practice restraints and non-solicitation of patients or clients could be a 5-hour topic we could discuss.
Easily. We don't have 5 hours, Julian.
it is quite it's an immense topic. I'll try and go through it fairly succinctly, but essentially you need to it needs to be drafted in a way that is not too broad, that is enforceable. A purchaser's lawyer will be looking at making sure it passes the reasonable business person's test, whether or not I refer to a physio clinic in, we'll put it in Hawthorne. You can't be saying, the purchaser's lawyer shouldn't be saying to you, you need to be restrained for 100 kilometers for 50 years. It's just unreasonable, and it's actually bad for the purchaser because it's unenforceable. The reasonableness of it is quite key, and it mentioning Hawthorne, you're looking at 5-6 Ks max. Maybe seven. It's quite geographically, it's kind of a magnet to the CBD. The closer you get to the CBD, the smaller amount of kilometers that you can actually document that will be seen as reasonable. I mean, the actual drafting is key as well. There's cascading clauses that need to be properly looked at. Again, there's a more purchaser responsibilities, but you will be asked to do this. So you need to make sure that you're properly abreast of what you're signing, and what you're signing will be, again, go to Hawthorne. It will look like I'd say it'd be 7 kilometers, 6 kilometers, 5 kilometers. That's probably what it will look like. There just needs to be that cascading manner, and whether or not it's 2 years, 1 year, the years is trickier to decipher whether or not it's more reasonable, but the kilometers is fairly related to the CBD of Melbourne or Sydney or wherever. Mm. The drafting is pretty key. If you're disinclined to agree to practice restraints, your purchaser's going to ask why. If they sniff anything out that you will be practicing close by, or if you've got a periodical license around the corner and hasn't been disclosed, they'll find out. So if you're disinclined to agree to reasonable practice restraints, then it decreases the value of your practice. There's not a lot of ways you can get around it. They are enforceable. They are enforceable if they're properly drafted and they are reasonable. So when you see remarkably wide restraints, it's trickier to enforce. The non-solicitation of patients and employees and suppliers is fairly straightforward. It's not as difficult to actually draft, but just don't do it. The difference, because I know there's a lot of literature out there that has essentially lowered the threshold on whether or not these practice restraint clauses are actually enforceable. They're more attuned to employee relationships and not purchasers buying and paying considerable amounts from the vendor for their practice. There's a far greater weight placed on the practice restraints and placed on breaches of those practice restraints. There's far more weight placed on them than an employer who's been at your practice for 2 years, who has started up 4.5 kilometers down the road in a 5K restraint. There's a big difference there, but unfortunately the literature gets molded together. So just with that, they need to be properly looked at, and you need to consider how reasonable you want to be with your drafting.
I wish I could share the details around my sale in terms of where the restraints started and where they finished and how many hours of lawyer awesome I invested in that negotiation. That was by far and away the densest conversation that we had, because my freedom meant the most to me in that well, that was one of the things that meant the most as a good outcome for me in the sale process. So it's okay to kind of challenge and work through that in a really good kind of process as well. And I guess we don't have time, but there's so many questions around what your role will be if you in fact want to stay on with the buyers as well. That is just, you're then negotiating a potential employment or consulting role with the buyers as well. So that's the second round of fun.
Absolutely. And if you're engaged as a service provider or if you're engaged as a strict employee, it really is the purchaser's model that you need to fit in with. The purchaser's model might be they'll be relying on their accountant to give them advice as to how they want you structured. If they want you structured as an employee, that's all and good. You'll get your entitlements. If you're structured as a services provider, then yeah, you'll be paying your own super. You'll be needing an ABN. So the funny thing is with what's up for the lawyers, the restraints is also critical with whether or not you're staying on. Does your 1 or 2 year restraint commence from when you sell the practice, or does it commence from when you eventually leave the practice if you're consulting after? Because if you sell your practice in December of this year and then you leave December next year, should your 2 years or 1 year practice restraint commence then or now? Mm. I, of course, if I was acting for the purchaser's lawyer, you need to insist, particularly if you're staying on, because your face is still there in front of the patients and clients. You need to make sure, well, the purchaser will be making sure that the restraints commence from your termination of your consultancy agreement. But it doesn't always, for some people, that's not something that Fair Work needs there's no statutory requirements for that. That's more negotiation. Some people don't want that commencement of the restraint to be from when they terminate from the consultancy. They just want it as a settlement date.
Yeah. All righty. So still selling, still negotiating. There's piles of documents and there's meetings and there's teleconferences and Zoom calls and a couple of sleepless nights as it seems so close, but then it just seems so far because the next thing didn't quite work or it did work or what have you. What if we can kind of, we're not going to cover everything, if we could sort of maybe shift to the typical documents that you're going to be kind of working across. What are the typical documents that are going to be laid out on the desk for conversation?
Yeah, so the vendor's lawyer typically prepares the sale agreement. And so you'll be looking at it depends on your structure, of course, but typical is a sale of goodwill, plant, equipment, and stock. And stock is actually just make sure with your deed, when you're doing DD, make sure you have, and your negotiations, make sure you have your stock and consumables in that negotiation. And it's not an afterthought because it can be quite expensive. But yeah, the sale of goodwill, plant, and equipment agreement. If it's a multiple owner practice that has a company or a unit trust, or if it's a partnership, yeah, you'll be looking at a sale of shares or units agreement or a sale of partnership agreement. And there will also be need to be new leases or a transfer of the existing lease and disclosure statements. And unfortunately with a lot of the sale of shares and units and sale of partnership agreements, there'll also be need to be all the ASIC documentation. Your accountant should guide you through the requirements at settlement, so the notices of resignation, all of that. They're settlement conditions precedent that they need to be provided to your lawyer, and then you provide them to the purchaser's lawyer. There's deeds of accession to the partnership agreements or fresh partnership agreements. There's a lot of documentation. One thing that isn't really advertised out there, I guess, is just something that needs to be produced early, is the Section 52 statement if you are selling for under $450,000. So that's fairly critical. Your accountant will prepare that for you, provides financials and trading information for your purchaser. So that does need to be provided as soon as possible. With the leases, just be cognizant. It does get there because a lot of practitioners lease from independent third party landlords. They're not part of your sale, so then they're moving to their own time. They unfortunately won't prioritize if you're dealing with an agent or if you're dealing with the landlord's lawyer or the landlord directly. Hopefully, you have a good relationship with the landlord. But if there's a requirement for a variation to the lease, make sure you have time. Make sure you give them enough time to actually get it done. Make sure that the variation of lease is, I mean, if you're a vendor, you don't want the variations to say that the lease needs to completely change and settlement is conditional on that. You don't want that, but the purchaser might insist. So those complexities, those lease complexities and transferring, actually getting all the parties together, that's why what we try to manage. And we try and have everyone on the same page and everyone in the same timeline. We don't always get there with settlement dates. We get most of them on the date where everyone's happy. But yeah, the independent third party landlords are tricky to deal with.
Yeah. You sort of described yourself and your role as a project manager, because there's a lot of moving parts. Is that kind of a fair and fit description of the lawyer's role along with their legal skills?
It's an evolved role that lawyers need to your lawyer needs to make sure that they have the intermediary between a lot of parties here. Mm. So they need to know who they're speaking to and who the industry, who you know, they know their financiers, and the financiers have they appropriate finance. They need to be speaking with the brokers and the agents because they can get a lot of information out of them and a lot of timings, and they can press urgencies through brokers to purchasers, lawyers, without going through, there are different channels that they can discuss things through. So, yeah, the evolution of the lawyer isn't just, yeah, do your documents. I'm not going to speak to anyone else. The broker can sort it out. You want it done well, and it's to be done in good time and with less stress. Your lawyer needs to be quite on top of all the moving parts. Mm. And yeah, that's only done by having quite a knowledge stream in the industry, knowing the industry partners. We have quite very good relationships with a lot of the industry partners, so it's a lot easier because we know we speak to them on quite regularly, so we know how to streamline the process. It is tricky when you're dealing with a purchaser who has someone who hasn't been involved with these kinds of matters, because there's a lot of I'd say that different. Yeah. And you don't want to be overbearing or you don't want to be essentially teaching them how to be doing this, because that's not your job. But you want to be assistant in any manner. Yeah. Best for purchasers lawyers to get commercial lawyers, though, rather than get a family lawyer who's never done before. It'll just make things a lot easier.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. Wow. Well, we have kind of skimmed across the top, but at least we've skimmed across the top.
Yeah. Look, it's the exit planning. Really, it's getting your practice ready to sell with fewer surprises during the legal process. That's get yourself your DD ready. Fewer surprises increases your buyer's confidence. It's increases your quality of bids from your practice if you've got everything ready, and it really streamlines things. And,
So I often get asked, what do I have to do to sell? And I say all the very same things that you need to have a really fabulous business that largely runs without you as well. So all of those development activities to develop and expand a business are pretty similar to the ones that you have in place to be sell ready, the few little differences there. So thank you for explaining all of that good stuff to us. If you would like to have the last word, the last little couple of tips for business owners who are starting about selling or exiting.
Yeah, look, it's been a pleasure to talk. And if any of the listeners do want to make contact, happy to discuss all of this information gratis, of course. We have a lot of time to talk to people. It's always good to talk to people who are thinking about selling, looking to sell in the future, or looking to sell before Christmas, which sometimes we get 2 weeks beforehand. But look, we can do it. It's what we do. But yeah,
wow,
the
2 weeks.
Best thing to do. Yeah. There's a few that have been like that, and it's been immense. Yeah, as I said before, with the risk restraints, and those matters are immense, but. Yeah, get yourself ready early. It's get your team ready early, and you'll be fine if you get everything early. You're of course you'll be fine. You'll be less You'll be less, there's less complexities now if you get everything ready early. Yeah.
All righty. So in the show notes, we will put links through to your website and so that people can reach out and find you. So thank you so much. Let's make sure that we get the next conversation happening sooner than later. And maybe it could be really interesting to look at perhaps next time about what happens when there's a internal sale where a business partner or a team member kind of buys in or buys out as well. So that's kind of a whole different. Yeah, let's try and get that done next year. Alrighty, Julian, thank you.
Thanks very much, Kat.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Private Practice Made Perfect podcast. For show notes and other resources, please visit practicemadeperfectpodcast.com. While you are there, you can subscribe for future episodes and continue your business adventure with me. And please be sure to share this and other episodes with your friends and colleagues. The Private Practice Made Perfect podcast is brought to you by Experts on Air Podcast Network.